I'm an alcoholic. I'm a lawyer, and my name is Eli. And only the first of those cannot be changed. Everybody catch Annie last night? Wasn't that just fantastic? It really was. Someone once said to me that no one is too dumb or uneducated to get this program. There are some, however, who think they're too smart or educated to get it. And that was certainly the case with me in the very beginning. I am very impressed. Yesterday we had our first lawyers in AA meeting, and we had a full house. And I didn't expect another full house today. And it was a test of all of you to find this place to begin with. Can you imagine if you'd had a few drinks in you? But I'm looking out at the audience, and most of you here are lawyers, wannabe lawyers, need a lawyer, or don't like lawyers. And that gives us a full house. I'm going to ask for a moment of silence in gratitude for the AA recognition of their recoveries over the last 70 years. We have, for your attention, and hopefully they will allow you to identify with their stories, three speakers that are coming from all over the United States. We have Joe Ben, did I say it right, Joe, from Texas, who is our first speaker. Welcome him, please.
I'm Joe Ben Wittenberg. I'm a grateful alcoholic. By the grace of a loving God that I found through the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous, I haven't had any alcohol or any minor mood-altering chemicals since June the 26th of 1988. For that, I'm truly grateful. A lot of people in my family are real grateful about that, too. I was just thinking, growing up, I always had a lot of fears and insecurities and felt very inadequate. When I went to school in the first grade, I didn't have a drink, but I sure could have used one. I heard an alcoholic describe it. It seemed like, whenever I got to school, that it seemed like everybody else had already gotten together, had a little meeting, decided what the rules were going to be, and I missed the meeting. I got there about 30 minutes late, and everybody else seemed to know what they were doing and seemed to be comfortable in their own skin, and I wasn't. And so I started trying to fit in. I started trying to do what everybody else did and, just did the best I could. But I always had those fears and insecurities and really just felt inadequate. When I finally started drinking, I found the solution to my problems. Not only did the fears leave me, but I was able to be around other people. I could deal with all the situations that were going on in my life. I thought that I had found the answer to all of life's problems. But almost immediately after I started drinking, even though it was the answer to all of my living problems, it started causing me problems. I remember when I went off to school, I started drinking, and I almost immediately started having wrecks. And then I started losing my car. I thought that any time you were going to go out and have a good time at a party or doing anything at night, that involved a lot of drinking, and there was going to be a certain amount of time during the night that you just weren't going to remember. I thought that's what happened to everybody. It wasn't until I got to Alcoholics Anonymous that I found that had a name. It was called a blackout, and that was almost a certain sign of alcoholism. But I thought that was just common. I thought everybody did that. And if you didn't do that, you really weren't having a whole lot of fun. As I said, you know, I started losing my car, and I remember the first time I lost my car, I had just gotten back from a big party that night, and I woke up the next day, and I couldn't find my car, and I was living in the dorm at that time. And my roommate and I, who later turned out to be a lawyer, too, went out, and we organized a little search party to look for Joe Ben's car. And, you know, we looked a long time, but we finally found it. And I tell you, I don't think there's anything quite as heartwarming as an alcoholic being reunited with his car. You know, and that was to happen a number of times to me. I had been involved in some athletics growing up, and after I got out of law school, I had at first thought I was going to be a tax lawyer, but after I took torts and some of the trial-related courses, I decided I wanted to be a trial lawyer. It just seemed like it fit my personality, and then going down and trying cases, a lot of the people that were trying lawsuits were out drinking and having a good time, and that was kind of a badge of courage. I really enjoyed that. I've been trying lawsuits for a little bit over 30 years now, and I guess for the last 20 or so, I've been representing doctors and lawyers when they got sued, which is a real intellectually stimulating practice. But after I started practicing law, even though I love to drink, and alcohol, as I said, was a solution to all my problems, I almost immediately started having problems too. In various ways, in addition to the minor wrecks that I might have or losing my car, from time to time would say things to people that they thought was inappropriate, and especially if you say that to your senior partners when you're an associate, you know, that doesn't go over real well. You know, I had been told at home that I might have a drinking problem. I never did hear that at the courthouse or with lawyers, but I'd been told at home that I might have a drinking problem. And one day, as I was there by myself, I came across a Reader's Digest, and it had an article in it that was entitled something like, "You Think You May Have a Drinking Problem." And since I was there by myself and nobody was looking, I picked it up, and it turned out to be the 20 questions that I'm sure we're all familiar with. I started reading the questions, and, I always thought I was smart. I really am not, but I always thought I was. And I could tell by the way the questions were phrased that if you answered too many of these questions yes, that they were probably going to tell you you had a drinking problem. So I went through the test, and I took it, and I gave myself the benefit of the doubt. And, I got down to the end, and it said if you answered one yes, you may have a problem. If you answered two yes, you do have a problem. You probably do have a problem. If you answered more than two yes, you definitely have a problem. You need to get some help. I'd answered almost all of them yes, even giving myself the benefit of the doubt. So I did exactly what any self-respecting alcoholic lawyer would do. I retook the test. And I cheated. And because I knew the answers, and even giving myself the benefit of the doubt and cheating, I still got a majority of them right. So at that point, I knew I needed to start constructing my defense. In case somebody ever mentioned the possibility that I might have a drinking problem. And so, my defense went along the lines of, well, I've still got a good job. I show up every day. I've got a wife. I've got a family. You know, two cars. Mortgage is paid for. I always told myself, and I really believed it right up until the very end, you know, that you just leave me alone. I'm not hurting anybody but myself. And I really believe that. Cutting to the chase, through a series of bad breaks and misfortunes, I had more and more problems. And then one night it all came to a head. I'd been out drinking late with some of my partners and managed to put my car in the bottom of a ditch. And again, I did what any self-respecting alcoholic lawyer would do. I tried to drive out of it. I couldn't get out of it. The car was totaled. The policeman that came to investigate the accident told me I was clearly drunk, but as it turned out, he and I had some common acquaintances, and he ended up giving me a ticket for negligent collision that night. I got a ride home with a wrecker driver, and I got home to learn that that had been the night of my son's all-sports banquet, at which he had gotten an award. And, you know, it was at that point that I knew I could no longer continue to say that I'm not hurting anybody but myself. And I was very fortunate because a little while after that I went to our state bar convention. And there was a lawyer there that was a good friend of mine. I'd gone to law school with him, and I'd known him for a long time. His practice was similar to mine. And he was a good friend. We'd party together, but I'd noticed that for the last little period of time that he didn't drink whenever we went out. And the most amazing thing was that he seemed to be okay with that. And I couldn't imagine, you know, functioning and living without alcohol or something to make me change the way that I felt. And so I said to him, I said, you know, Mike, I noticed that you're not drinking. And I was been having some trouble, and I was just wondering how you were doing that. And his eyes just lit up, you know. And he did exactly what our book tells us that we're supposed to do. He told me what he had been like, what had happened, and what he was like now. And, you know, I wanted what he had. You know, he was comfortable in his own skin. He was around other people. He was practicing law. And, you know, that was exactly what I wanted to be able to do. But I couldn't imagine living without drinking or doing something else to change the way I felt. And Mike told me that he had gotten recovery. He was sober about 4 or 5 years at that time, and he'd done it through Alcoholics Anonymous. And he lived in Austin. I live in Beaumont. I came back to Beaumont, and through the help of my family doctor, got in touch with a man who took me to my first meeting and became my sponsor. And he told me what Eli mentioned. He said, you know, there's a lot of people around here that are sober, and there's never been anybody that's been too dumb to get this program, but there's a lot of people that are too smart, and you better hope you're not one of them. And, you know, that was kind of a scary deal to me. And the other thing he told me was that, you know, I needed to go to the meetings, and instead of looking for all the reasons why I was different from everybody else, to look for the similarities, listen to the feelings, listen to what they're talking about, and try to identify with them. And, you know, I was able to do that. I did something that's very uncharacteristic for me. I started following directions from my sponsor. I don't know why I did that. Part of it is, you know, I think I wanted him to like me. I wanted to make an A in AA. And, you know, but I did. And what it seemed like there were a bunch of people that were there, and that were comfortable in their own skin, and they had what I wouldn't have been able to identify at that time, but what I've come to know is some peace and some serenity, like those quiet eyes that you see in Alcoholics Anonymous. And they all seem to be saying that they got those the same way. They got those by going to lots of meetings, reading the book, getting a sponsor, and working the steps with the sponsor, and praying, and when you can, reach out to another alcoholic. And I started doing that. And by doing the simple prayer that my sponsor suggested, and working the steps, you know, the obsession to drink or use anything else was removed. And then I remember this, you know, just like it was yesterday. I was in the middle of a trial. It was a particularly difficult trial, and I would have been having, you know, some things weren't going my way. Went to a meeting one night at my home group, and I remember walking out of the meeting that night. It was in the middle of the week, and I had this just overwhelming, warm feeling, which I know was my higher power, and I just knew everything was going to be all right. You know, that the trial may not turn out the way I thought it, I think it want, I wanted it to or thought it ought to. you know, we may win, we may lose, whatever happens, so it was going to be all right. And it was just that overwhelming, warm feeling that I've come to know as my higher power, and knowing that everything's going to be all right. I continued to practice, and I wondered how I was going to be able to continue to practice law, especially trial law, with involving negotiations with other people, consistent with trying to practice the principles in all of my affairs. There's something about rigorous honesty that seemed to be a possible problem there. And I heard a lawyer from Texas, from Dallas, actually, who talked about doing that. And he talked about really all our job is as lawyers is to do what we can do. You know, I thought I had to control what the jury thought. I thought I had to control what my witnesses said, what my client said, what the judge did. And I spent a lot of time trying to do that. You know, I thought that I was going to be judged by the results. And what he said is all we can do is our job. We can do the best we can to prepare our clients. We can do our best to prepare for trial, but we don't win or lose. The jury decides what the facts are. The fact finder decides what the facts are. It's my job to do the next right thing and leave the results to God. And, you know, when I can do that today, my life is a whole lot better. I still get caught up in trying to control the results. You know, my problem all along was I thought I was going to be judged by the results. And, you know, and that's really what society, I think, tells us. But all I can do is do my best as a lawyer and then leave the results to God. And when I can do that, I can go to trial. I can concentrate better. I'm not so caught up in my own stuff. And in life, too, if I can just concentrate on doing the next right thing and leaving the results to God, it all works out for the best. I had a situation come up one time. I was involved in a case that involved a doctor who had performed an abortion. It's kind of a high-profile case that had some press, and you know, we had done everything to get prepared, and I managed to miss a deadline, even though our, you know, the other side knew who our experts were and had deposed them. I missed designating my experts by one day. And those of you that practice trial law know what that means. And we had two different hearings during trial trying to get the judge to use his discretion to let us use our experts. And the judge decided not to do that. My doctor was there. My doctor's insurance company representative was there, and the vice president of that company was there. And I came out of the second hearing, and it would have been real easy for me to say, well, you know, this is, the judge is a pro plaintiff judge, which he was. You know, he had discretion here, and he's just exercising it wrongly. Because I was active in the program of Alcoholics Anonymous and making a lot of meetings and working with other people, working with other alcoholics, I came out and I told my client that I'd made a mistake and we weren't going to get to use our experts. And you know, he was surprised. My doctor was surprised. Everybody was surprised, but. You know, we were able to go ahead and complete the trial, and the jury made the decision that they should have made. You know, I tell you that to let you know that I wouldn't have done that before. Before recovery, before the 12 steps, before I had a relationship with the God of my understanding, I wouldn't have done that. You know, when I got to Alcoholics Anonymous, I heard people talking about being grateful alcoholics. And I could understand being grateful that you were sober, but I couldn't understand anybody being grateful that they had a chronic, incurable disease that was often fatal. Today, I tell you, I'm a grateful alcoholic. If I hadn't been an alcoholic, I wouldn't have been forced to come to Alcoholics Anonymous. I wouldn't have been forced to get a sponsor and work the steps. But by doing that, I developed a relationship with the God of my understanding. I've been able to find a way to live life, be happy, be peaceful. And I know today that even though I always felt that I was incompetent and inadequate, I am. It's only when I have a relationship with my higher power that I choose to call God that I am competent, and the power flows through me, not from me. Thank you.
I want you to know that I was a social drinker for 15 years. Then I had my first drink. Some of you that are in the back, if you would like to, I'm very pleased you've got a full room. We've got some chairs up here. If you'd like to take them, please. And some of you that are sitting maybe on the floor and can't see and all you can do is hear, we've got a wide open spot right up here in the front if it'd be better for you if you don't want to scoot out before we're done. Okay. While you're coming up, I want to identify with Joe here, because I had a lot of blackouts right from the very beginning, but I was blessed with blackouts. I never wanted to know what I did. I was known as Two Beers Eli right from the get-go. And in college, I still remember it to this day. It was whiskey, 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 we used to chant, that made us feel so frisky. It was good old wine that made us feel so fine. And it was that beer, beer, beer that made me want to cheer. And it was that good old brew that made me want to. We were a young man at that time. You got to remember that, okay? Our second speaker this evening is Maria, and she is from Puerto Rico. And she said, can I deliver it in Spanish? I says, if it's from the heart, they'll understand. Okay? Maria, if you would, please.
Good afternoon. My name is Maria, and I'm an alcoholic. Buenas tardes. Mi nombre es Maria, y soy una alcohólica. First of all, I'm going to apologize because I'm mainly a Spanish speaker. I'm going to try to do my best talking to you in this afternoon. I come to my first meeting in AA in 1992. A year later that I finished the law school. I failed to pass the bar board for the first time because I tried to take the board drunken. And this is very difficult. But I'm not planning to go to the bar exam, to the board drunken. This is not part of my plan. I take a license from my full job. I'm mostly studying in the night because I have a full-time working woman. And I take a license from my work, from my job, for 6 months to take the boards. I planning my money. I put the money in the bank because I need to pay in advance all my expenses during the last months of the studies and the months of the board. But I don't know how, but 3 months before the board, I don't have a single penny in my bank account. I've been drinking everything. And I remember that I asked a friend, a very close friend of mine, put this money in your account because I don't want to have too much money by myself. And I'm going to ask you a very big favor. If I ask you that you give me this money back, don't do this. You keep this money because it's for paying the rent of the apartment. I live alone. I I need to address this. I'm a working single woman living by myself, and I need to pay everything for me. Well, at 3 months, I don't have a penny in my account, and I'm starting to see how I can convince my friend that I need the money, because I tell him, don't do anything. Keep this money in your bank because I needed to pay for the expenses. Well, I don't remember, but I think that I made a big mess. And I'm telling a long story. I don't know, but he believed me and he gave me the money. Well, and I drink the last of my money. I go to the bars. I've been drinking almost every day by this time, and all day from morning to afternoon, from the afternoon to the night, I'm drinking all the time. And I remember the first day, the bars in Puerto Rico are extending for 3 days. And I remember the first day, at the very beginning of the bar, I couldn't read anything in the papers. I couldn't see anything. I don't understand anything. And I'm very afraid. And I'm only think, oh my God, I'm going to fall in the floor in the middle of this room. Plenty of people. Everybody's going to know that I'm very bad. Well, I'm not going to do this. If I need to go outside of this room, I'm going over my feet. No one is going to take me out. I finish the day, and I start drinking again, and I take the board for the 3 days. I need to go back to my work 2 months after the board, because it is the end of my license. And by this time, I don't have a single penny in my account, and I need to sell my car. I can buy another one since I sell this. I need to sell my car to pay the rent for the next 2 months that I need to wait until I go back to my work. Of course, 2 months later, the board says, well, you failed the board, and I resigned to my work, to my full-time work, and I started to work in the firm with a friend, and I continue to ring almost every day. I don't know you, but when I finish the law school, I have this amount of time that I don't know what to do with this amount of time, because for 4 years, I've been working, studying, and drinking, and at the end, drinking. By the end of the studies, when I remember the first time when I go back to my home for my job, it is 4 p.m. in the afternoon, and I say, well, what am I going to do at this time in my house? This is the first time that I arrived to my house in 4 years. At 4 p.m., well, I'm stopped in the liquor store, and, you know, I start to use all of this time drinking in my house. I spend most of my time drinking in my home. My home was my bar, my very personal bar. I don't need people to drink since my beginning in the alcohol. I never need anyone to drink with me. I dream very good alone. I can never define myself as a social drinker. I was a social drunkard, but never a social drinker because I telling you, I never planning to get drunk, but I always finish drunk. Since the first time I remember I drink, I always finish drunk. This is something that never changes. Well, I failed the bar. I have a new job. And 6 months later, I feel that my life is over. I feel very bad. I have very bad feelings about myself. When you enter in the law school, I don't know why, but the professors always talk about the boards. And the boards start to be some kind of an obsession in your life. The board. But fail the board was the worst things in your life. And that's for me too. Because this is part of the ego too. And 6 months later, I think that I can handle for more time the way that my life has turned. And I need some help. I know that the alcohol is the problem in my life. I know very well this. I can define myself at this moment as an alcoholic, but I know very well that I have a big problem that I can handle with myself. And this is with the alcohol. I'm telling you that I called for the first time to ask AA in 1986. Yeah, 6 or 7, 8 years that my first meeting. Because I remember that in 1986, I started the celebration of the Christmas time on November, immediately after the Thanksgiving Day, and I can finish past February. And I said, well, something probably is going wrong because I'm drinking mostly all of the weekend since like the Christmas time, and the Christmas time is over by far. And I called for the first time to AA in 1986. I always try to be a very direct woman because I not like to go around the problems. I wanted to address as far as I identified. I'm saying this is some of the best sins that I have in my life with the alcohol. And I remember I'm calling to AA in Puerto Rico and ask if they can send me some information about the alcoholism. And the guy in the phone said, it's for you or for a family? Oh, no, it's for myself. I wanted to know if I'm an alcoholic. But I never received the information, but I remember I asked for the address of a meeting, and they gave me an address of a meeting. By this time, I live in the center of the capital cities. Atorrey is the most of the financial place. I live in this place, and this meeting is not so far in Rio Piedras, another part of San Juan metropolitan area. And they gave me this information. I don't put this information in any paper. I only put it in my memory. And I remember that I started to dress, change my clothes the day that's supposed to be. I said, I'm going to visit this group because I wanted to know. But before the meeting, I call a friend. And I tell my friend, oh, you know, I have some information about AA group, and I'm going to visit because I think that I have problem with the alcohol. And he asked me, what are you drinking? You know, right now, mostly, I drink beers. And he said, well, no one is an alcoholic who drinks beers. And I said, do you think so? It's probably, I don't know, but I really don't know. It is could be true. I really don't know. And he said, no, the people who have drinking problem are the people who drink rum or something like this. And he said, I don't like rum, I'm telling him. But I remember in that moment I drink beer, but before the beers, or the gin, and before the gin, or the vodka, and you start to change it because you think, well, it's probably the vodka is going, making me feel bad. I'm going to change. Yeah, to the gym, and the gym started to feel bad. I think that the gym is hurting my stomach, and probably the beer is going, well. He said this to me, and I said, well, probably I'm a little exaggerated. I'm going to stay here. I'm not going to the meeting. It's taken me to 1992 to arrive to my first meeting, but I'm telling you, I never forget the address of the group. Never. And I remember that in July 23, 1992, I wake up feeling like the worst person in the world. I feel very bad. I've been drinking almost for 7 days without stopping. Everything is shaking in my life, everything. I can smoke because I wanted the cigarette with my hands. And I call again to AA. At this time, I need to go with the operator because I can look in there, in the guy, telephone guy, because I can read him. I'm very bad. And I remember the information of the meeting. And I called to the office, and I said to the guy who picked the phone, I called because I wanted to know if the group that has the meeting on Thursday at 8:30 in the Church Cristo Redentor in the Urbanización El Paraíso in Río Piedras is still open. And he says, yes, it's still open. All right. You are looking for a group for a friend or a family? And I said again, no, it's for me. Thank you very much. I hang the phone. I sit in my home, and I wait until 8 o'clock to go to my first meeting. And this was the first day of my life. Since this day has passed 13 years in 2 weeks, I passed the board. But it takes me a long time. I wait around 5 years after I arrived to AA to start to think, and I'm ready for going over the boards again. Because when I come to AA, I start to think that the most important for me is getting sober and stay sober. And this takes around 5 years. I said, well, everyone says, you don't make big decisions, big changes in your life in the first year. I think that for me, I need more time than 1 year, because I know that if I'm trying to go and I'm successfully past the board, this is not going to be a good thing for me. Yeah, for my ego especially. I'm going to start that I can do it by myself again. And probably I can go out of AA. And I say, no, I need these guys, I need these people, I need this programming in my life, and I need time to be sure that I can address anything without alcohol. And I spent this 5 years working with one of my friends in his office. He paid very low pay for me. All right. He is touching me. But he advised me that he's going to touch me. Don't worry. because he's...
Yes.
Yes, and I said yes. Well, for ended, I need to tell you that I spent 5 years making my sobriety very strong, because I know that the legal world was a very hard scenario for working. You can deal every day with pressure, with a lot of pressure, and you need to be a very strong person, especially when you was a woman like me. I'm a woman, I work in a family law, and this is very hard for me sometimes to deal with another lawyers in a very masculine legal system that all the time try to push me to do the same in the same way that the all of the guys do the same. And I don't want it to be like the other guys. I tell you that we have a few women in AA, lawyers, women in AA. I think that I'm the only one in the groups in Puerto Rico, but I'm going to work very hard in the next years to bring more women's lawyers in AA, because I know very well a lot of women in the legal field that have very big problem with the alcohol, like me. And I wanted to share with all of these women and another guys too the habits that I have found since I arrived to AA. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Maria. I want to let everyone know that in the beginning, I could not and I refused to identify with women. And I would only go to men's stags because I could not handle women, whatever their problems were. I want you to know that probably the greatest wisdoms that I have gotten from Alcoholics Anonymous have come from women, and thank you for that. After I had exhausted 3 psychiatrists, 2 psychologists, and 2 medical doctors, a friend finally said, "Eli, why don't you call AA?" And I'm coming off a binge, and I remember I went home, and that just went over and over in my mind. I went in, and I opened up the book to the front, Alcoholics Anonymous. I dialed up, and a lady answered, and I says, "Hello, this is Fred, and I've got a friend who's got a problem." And she says, "Okay, Fred, where do you live?" And I gave her my address. 20 minutes later, there was the knock on the door, and there's where it all began. Okay. Next, if we will, please hear from Mike.
And my name is Mike. Yes, I'm an alcoholic. It's good to be here today. It's good to be sober. I've enjoyed the other 2 speakers quite a bit. I feel a little, I have mixed feelings like I often have in life about things. And listening to Joe Ben start out today with that kind of little sad story about the fact that when he was even in first grade, he thought other people had met ahead of time and planned things out and given the rules. I've been sitting here the whole time thinking, I'm going to ask you, please don't tell him about our meeting before this meeting, will you? Yeah. I met him the other day, and it's a pleasure to have met him and to hear Maria today. And I'm actually looking forward to having Eli touch my leg, too, while I'm speaking. He warned us he would do that if we talked too long, but he warned us with pleasure, if you know what I mean. It was almost like an invitation to talk too long. I'm here from Riverside, California, which is in Southern California, and in the time allowed to talk to you, I'll stick an awful lot to the law portion of my life. I'm a prosecutor, and one of the reasons I wanted to bring that up early is I told Maria I was a prosecutor, and in her charming way, she said, "I don't get along with prosecutors." Well, I've gotten along with several family law lawyers, and on a personal level, so I'll keep your card for later. I've been sober since May the 30th, 1980, so I just celebrated 25 years last month. And coming up to this conference, this is my 3rd international that I've come to. 2 have been in Canada. I came to Montreal in 1985, and that was a great conference, and then San Diego, and then this one. You know, last night, though, something hit me again that always impresses me at the internationals, at least. And that is how special those of us who are sober really are. I mean, how truly fortunate. I know it's something said often, or I say it often, or hear it at my meetings frequently, but the reality really hit me last night sitting in that stadium of how many people, and we're just a fraction of Alcoholics Anonymous, obviously, but really have had their lives changed so significantly. But more importantly, I think what hit me was how small a portion I am. No matter how important I might feel sometimes, or useful even sometimes in a nice way, the reality is Alcoholics Anonymous as a movement is just fine whether I'm here or not. And you know, we have a tradition out in Southern California where people often ask for the hands of people in their first 30 days of sobriety at the start of a meeting and to identify. And I used to have a friend who would speak, and he would get up and he would always ask for the hands of people in their last 30 days of sobriety. And you know, to this day, that's a real chilling kind of a question for somebody like me, because the reality is I'm a bad drunk. I'm the kind of person that the Big Book talks about, and Bill Wilson described accurately when saying that some people were seldom mildly intoxicated, always more or less insanely drunk. I wasn't the kind of person, if you came to a party or my house or anywhere where I was drinking, where you had to wonder if I was drunk or not. It wasn't like people were whispering and saying, "You think maybe he's had too much." It was a foregone conclusion. You know, I react badly to alcohol. I grew up in an alcoholic home, which is a real surprise, isn't it? And I was born in a town in upstate New York and lived in an Italian-American community where people really lived segregated by their nationalities. And we had a connection with Canada in my family. And my connection with Canada was the stories I heard about for years. My family were smugglers. They brought liquor in during Prohibition. And I actually have uncles named Rocco and Dominic and people like that. And they fascinated me, and my father fascinated me probably more than all the men in the family. You know, he ran a bar, he owned a bar, and then ended up running nightclubs where there were the big groups that played in those days, and we ended up in Florida at a nice club. And, I mean, it was a glamorous kind of a life to somebody like me. You know, I've learned a lot of things that turned out to be very bad for me over the years. But being in those little joints when I was young and smelling the way alcohol smelled and the way bars were air-conditioned and nice and playing the little pinball games, you know, and even in those days with the women coming up and just, I was 4 or 5 years old being around those places, and ladies would come up in the mornings, give us little kisses on the cheek with that alcoholic breath, you know, and money to play these little pinball games, and they touched me deeply. They imprinted my soul in many ways. And as I say, because it's true for me, if it hadn't been for alcohol and women, I'd have had a good life. I just never did real well with either. And you know, because of the shortness of the time here, let me just tell you, the drinking, I can't remember who talked about, Maria talked about drinking in blackouts from the very beginning. So did I. I mean, I did not know until I came to Alcoholics Anonymous that when people said they were drunk, they didn't mean the same thing I meant. I had blackouts and hangovers always. I've got three daughters, and they've been around Alcoholics Anonymous almost all of their lives, and they hesitate to talk about their drinking with me for unknown reasons. And one day we were driving along, and my middle daughter forgot that little rule of thumb, and she said to me, she said, "You know, I got a terrible hangover today." And she was going on and on about it, and then it dawned on her we were in an area she wished she hadn't gotten into. And she said, but wait a minute, I want to tell you something. I'm not like you. She said, "When I go out to drink, I go out to purposely get drunk." And I don't know what she thought I was doing those nights. In early 1980, I was obviously coming to what was going to be the end of my drinking career with no clue. I know, like you know, that to be a member of Alcoholics Anonymous or to get sober and even stay sober, you don't have to want sobriety initially. You don't, at least I didn't. I didn't have to understand it. I didn't have to like God. I didn't like groups. I didn't join things. I didn't speak in public. I didn't do any of the kind of things that it seemed to me you'd have to do to be a member of this kind of organization. In fact, I did all the opposite things. I was selling real estate at the time, and I had more money than I'd ever had, which wasn't a lot, but it was a fair amount of money. I had my Mercedes, and I had my stuff, and I was driving around California and thinking I was pretty cool stuff. And I'll tell you real quickly about my last big drunk. I'd gone to Las Vegas because one of my other fantasies had always been to be a professional poker player. And it's hard to do that on the $2 tables, but you have to win a lot of hands. And but I was up there, and I happened to, I was drinking. I'd met this lady up there. I was married, but that was a side issue. And and visiting with her and some other people, I started drinking kamikazes at this bar. Somebody gave me a Quaalude. And I came out of a blackout standing at a urinal in the casino, the public urinal in the casino. And some guy was shaking me and asking me if I was okay. Now, he was shaking me on the shoulder, asking me if I was okay. And I, true story, the next thing I knew, I came to in my room, and I was dressed the way I'd been the night before, and I was laying on my back, and I'd vomited straight up. And it was all over me. Now, I hadn't vomited in years from drinking. I know a lot of us die that way, choking to death in our own vomit. And that's how glamorous it had become for me. All that stuff about being a big shot, semi-criminal kind of a guy, and hanging around bars and chasing and doing all that stuff and being a gambler, that's how it ended for me that day. I was washing my own clothes out in the shower and getting sick again. I was so ill, physically ill. I mean, I truly poisoned myself with alcohol. I didn't have a problem being an alcoholic. That did not become an issue for me until I came to AAA. I had a warped enough idea about alcoholics that if people said to me in a bar, you drink badly, sometimes I took it as a compliment, depending on who might have said it. But when I came here, I knew what, no matter how you disguised it, about not drinking one day at a time, you were going to suggest that every day. And so all of a sudden, I wasn't so sure if I was alcoholic or not. And it was a lawyer who answered that question for me. Now, many of you probably know him. His name is Clint Hodges, Clint H. from Los Angeles. Clint's a member of the Pacific Group. And I was real new, and I heard him speaking at a meeting one evening, and he said, our first step doesn't say we're alcoholic. Our first step says we're powerless over alcohol. Ask yourself how well you drank when you did drink. And, you know, that was like a trick question for me, but I mean, because I drank terribly. Lots of things. One of the things I know for sure about myself is I often cannot see the hand of God working in my life when it's working, even to this day. I have to be really careful with that kind of thing. Because the things that have appeared to be the worst in my life, the worst opportunities, the biggest failures, the scariest deals turned out, in retrospect, of course, to be the perfect things that have made my life be what it is today. And I'll tell you real quickly, I ended up going to a treatment center. I was there 3 weeks, and I was a terrible patient. And on the last Sunday night I was in there, they had the Hospital and Institutions Committee come in to speak to us. And that used to piss me off every time they would come because it was always one guy. And I would point out to everybody else, that's not a committee. They would say the panel. those were the important issues I was focusing on at the time. And they said the panel's here. I go, it can't be a panel. It's the same guy again. And the panel was babbling about himself, and I was daydreaming about my life. And he said, you want to know what I found in Alcoholics Anonymous? And it irked me just enough to listen. And I thought, no, I don't want to know. And then he said it again, kind of cutesy. Want to know what I found in Alcoholics Anonymous? I thought, no. He was going to tell us anyway, but he just went through. Because he said, I'll tell you what I found. He said, I found a higher degree of mental comfortableness. He said, I have peace of mind. And he stunned me, because I had never had peace of mind that I know. I'd always been all the fast guys. One of them's here today in the back of the room. A friend of mine came from Riverside. There are several here that are here. And we drank and used together and ran around. And we were all much cooler than this little guy, the panel. Because he explained about his life. He was a butcher. And he said he was going to go home to a wife that he wanted to be with. And he was going to sleep on clean sheets. And he said he was going to get up in the morning and make his lunch and put it in his lunch pail and have breakfast with his children because he wanted to. And he said he was going to go to work and give them 8 hours of work for 8 hours of pay. And that he was going to come home, have dinner with his family because he wanted to. And then he was going to go to a meeting, drink coffee and smoke cigarettes and be with his friends, and he'd never had it so good. And he stunned me because he talked about the quality that was mentioned today by the other speakers. No matter what it's called, it's peace of mind, serenity. It's the ingredient, the result the people get who work the steps. The people who really and truly, it seems to me, try to turn their will and their lives over the care of God. And I was fascinated with the issue of God. I was fortunate enough to get sober at a time in California when Chuck C. was speaking often, and I would go hear him. My sponsor, who had come out of the Pacific Group, would take me around to hear him and Clancy all the time. And Chuck used to talk about the things I wished to be true but didn't believe to necessarily be true. And he would talk about, he'd say, if I ask you in the room how many of you believe in God, probably get 90 or 95%. But if I asked how many of you trust God, I'd probably get a totally different answer. And I knew he was talking about me because I didn't. I wanted to believe that was true. I wanted to believe that there was a higher power who truly took care of the details of my life. But I got the same direction Maria got. Not to make any major changes in the continental United States, we do it 1 year, the first year of sobriety. And I didn't. But I went backwards financially. And I went backwards in every other way, and I was panicked that I would never find a profession or a job or anything else that suited me, that I would like to do. And a couple of things happened that I was convinced were wrong. After a year, I got to get a job again, a little job that I didn't want as a probation officer in Orange County, California. And they put me in a gang area with kids. And I called my sponsor the very first day and said, I'm quitting. This is obviously a mistake. I should be an executive somewhere or something. I'm not going to. And he said to me, people like you are quitters. He said, you're not going to make any major changes for your first year of sobriety. And I stayed there and did the things that people like him told me to do on a daily basis and kept sobriety first. Now, it just so happened there was a law school in that little area, just in that little tiny square, couple mile square that I supervised. And I would drive by it all the time. I'd started law school twice before. One time I went 2 weeks. It had a bar right across the street. The next time I went to one half a class and went over and never went back. And again, for sake of time, I signed up at this law school in Fullerton. And I knew right away it was a mistake. I didn't like it. First class. And I called Don. I said, I'm quitting. And he says, you know, people like you are quitters. He said, you know, nobody cares if you become a lawyer or not, for God's sake. Just, can you finish something? I said, no, I can't. Obviously, I would. And he said, you're going to finish the class. And we did that throughout the time of law school. All the time of law school. And I was speaking at a place in the Hogue Hospital in Newport Beach on a Saturday night right after I'd taken the bar. And we have to wait, too. I took the bar in February that year. And that year, only like 26% of the people in California passed. And I was up there, and I was kind of being smart-aleck, and I was joking. And I said, you know, I know God takes care of families by now because mine's in pretty good shape. By then, my father had gotten sober, my brother had gotten sober, my mother was an Al-Anon, my wife was an Al-Anon, and life was going pretty good. And I said, I know the jobs even get taken care of pretty well. And I laughed and I said, but how about the bar exam? And several people, I didn't realize how many lawyers were in AA at the time. It was a big meeting, but lots of lawyers came up over after and said, yeah, he does, ha-ha, and they would walk off. And I experienced what I always experienced when I actually can surrender something. Somewhere along the way in those periods of months, somewhere in those weeks right before the results came out, it became okay. I didn't want to fail the bar. I did not want to not pass after all that work. But I knew whatever the result was, it was going to be okay. And it brought me that peace of mind that everybody talks about in Alcoholics Anonymous. And on May the 30th, 1986, on my AA birthday, I got the results in the mail that I'd passed. It was an unbelievable birthday present. And I was going to become a big-shot real estate lawyer. And got hired with this nice firm and was bored to tears. And I didn't know what to do. And my buddy who was sitting in the back had been on a jury. And a couple of things. Somebody had said, why don't you go work for the DA's office? And I didn't want to go back into anything having to do with criminal law at all. Because I was always in trouble. I'd been arrested and convicted, for God's sakes. You know, I'm the kind of person who's always got parochial school, was whipped every day. I know what it's like to be the bad guy. I can't be a prosecutor. And Ron said, why don't you talk to this young DA and see what he thinks. So we had breakfast, and he said to me, who do you think can help people more in a courtroom with alcohol problems? If you see somebody that you think, who do you think would be the most helpful? And, you know, I decided to take a chance, and it's been the best thing that's ever happened to me. One more time, I missed the fact. I've worked homicides now for the last 15 years. I do death penalty trials. I do big trials. I'm the chief deputy of our county, and it's a big county. We have 200 lawyers in our office. But let me tell you something. One of the concepts I had some trouble with early on was what's God's will and not when you see the kind of things that we see in our lives. We see them anyway, whether you're a lawyer or not. But in where I work, we go out to the scene of killings. And I know what it's like to have that kind of anger because I've had it, that kind of rage where I could hurt somebody that badly. I know what it's like to do those kind of things to people because I would have done them or have done some of them that I deal with in my professional life. And I'd go to meetings, and I was in a meeting one night, and a guy came in and said his 2-year-old son had died, and well-meaning AA said to him, God's will. We just don't understand things sometimes. And I'm not here to contradict that with anybody's belief, but let me tell you what I happened to cultivate for myself in order to stay here and trust God. If everything that happens in the world is God's will, there's no reason for me to pray for knowledge of God's will and the power to carry it out, in my opinion. Obviously, I'm able to do my own will that's not always in line with the higher powers. And so it's important for me to develop a relationship to ask God to give me guidance and direction to do His will. Because left to myself, with my defects of character, my anger, my lust, those kind of things, I can hurt people. I can do things that are wrong. I don't believe God condones them at all. Now, again, I'm not pretending to have inside information from God. What I'm saying is it developed for me that I know this in my own life. To the extent I'm able to trust that if I'm still and try to take direction, pray and meditate, and stay active in Alcoholics Anonymous, I've never had it so good. I've never had it so good. My friend Rhonda came up here with me to Canada today for this week, and I really appreciate her company and our relationship very much. And Randy and Ingrid, who are here too, and Ron, and to all of you. You know, I know this. I'll leave the International Convention this weekend better off than I was before. Not because of anything I gave, but because, again, being able to see that I'm one among many. Bill Wilson, I think, was a genius for many things. But one of them was his recognition about the need for humility. You know, I was the kind of person who was too shy. I would take an F in a class before I would get up and give a 5-minute talk. And I became a trial lawyer. And when you talk about turning it over to the jury, or turning over the result of a jury, I'm not going to do that. I'm only kidding, Joe Ben. I know that has to end up happening, too, but it's terrifying. I sometimes wonder if God's really in there with some of those people I've selected for the jury. That's convinced me more of God's power. Anyway, it's been really nice to be a part of this, and you know, to have put us at this end of the building, so far away, I guess there was no room in the refuse section. I couldn't even...